Now I have with me Mr. Dominique Lafond, who several of you know personally, but if not, you will know his wines. And so we are sitting at the winery. We've got a few of the wines which we're going to taste with you. Not, in fact, the first little grouping. Dominique has chosen to go with some wines that we actually want to sit and drink because they'll be in their primes. So we've got, I think, the 2009 Genevrière, the 2002 Perrier, a 92 Charme, and a 93 Clos-le-Bar, and a couple of reds. Anyway, good. Well, it's great to be with you again after a little layoff. So we can kick off as soon as I've got Dominique's attention back. Uh-huh. He can tell you a little bit. Well, maybe I'll start by saying that this is the first domain that I ever visited in Burgundy, late in 1981, and Dominique I met there. And Dominique took me, in fact, our first two visits were here and to domain Jean-François Costurie, but I chose to work with Dominique. So I've known him, therefore, for over 40 years, been enjoying and tasting his wines for all that time. We will shortly be publishing an incredible sort of 40-year retrospective of Dominique's complete career. And today, tonight, we'll just do one or two of the high points. So the domain dates back to the 1860s, here in this same place that I'm in. I'm just above the winemaking side and looking across to the house of Claude Labar. Been in the Lafond family all that time, and it was Comte Jules Lafond that really put it on the map. So, Dominique, you are there for the fourth
generation. Yes.
And Dominique has just handed over to his daughter, Léa, and his nephew, Pierre. But unfortunately, they're elsewhere doing what they need to do for the work for the domain today, so can't join us. But Dominique will be able to talk us through his wines. And you're going to begin with some younger wines, which are... I will just get marked 2017 Charme, 2017 Porrezo, 2014 Perrier. Dominique, do you want to start by talking a little bit about your Premier Cru holdings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Historically, the domain had four Premier Crus in Meursault, a fairly large batch of Meursault Charme, almost two hectares. In the upper part of the Meursault Charme vineyard. So it's next to Perrière, and it's really close to Puligny-Combette also. It's at the southern part of the Meursault Charme. There's a bit less than 1 hectare of Meursault Perrière in the northern part and the lower part of the Perrière, which actually is the best part of Perrière, the Perrière dessous, which that's how we say, lower part. Half an hectare of Meursault Genevrière, which is very close to the Perrière. There's 300 meters apart. There are three, yeah. Half an hectare there. And which is historically in the family for long also, Meursault Goutte d'Or, which is a bit less than half an hectare, 0.4 hectare. That's the four Premier Cru we had when I arrived. And we managed to get a small piece of Meursault Bouchère, which is quite high on the hill for a Premier Cru. Produces super elegant wines, and also 1 hectare of Porrezo, and I think we will taste one Porrezo today.
That's right, 2017.
Mm-hmm. So those two last vineyards have been added to the domain in 2011. So that makes that nowadays we, if you look at the map, we own all the six Premier Cru south of Meursault, which is the best part of the Premier Cru for Meursault. So it's all the vineyards between Meursault and Puligny-Montrachet. There's a few Premier Cru which are in the northern part of Meursault, whites, which we don't have.
Okay, so you've got twice 17 and once 14. So you've got the best two vintages probably of that decade.
Amongst the best, because if you take that decade, it's 10 to 20. There's a fair amount of good vintages in that decade. I like the 17 vintage for its balance. And it's very true to each terroir. I like the kind of zesty tension you have in the 2014, which to me could be one of the best white vintage if you like that style. The 17 will be slightly rounder than the 14, but I think there's a lot of breed and style in the 14. There's also more reduction in the 14, so they need more time or more air before you taste them.
I think they were all opened maybe about an hour ago. Okay. All these younger wines. Yeah.
Well, so 17 is a vintage which has been good from start, and I think will remain like that forever. It's got a great aging potential, but it's always showed very well, and it's a super charming vintage. The two vineyards you are tasting is Meursault Charme and Meursault Pourrousseau. I would do the Pourrousseau first if you can, and then taste the Charme afterward. It's okay if you do it the other way around. The Pourrousseau is always has a lot of power and a lot of tension, but to me, there's maybe a more elegance in the Meursault Charme, even if it's also a vineyard with a bit more soil than in the Perrier and Genevrière. But there's a richness in the Meursault Charme compared to Perrier or Genevrière. But I think there's more refinement than in the Pourrousseau. Maybe I'm wrong, because we've been amazed recently at the quality we are achieving with that vineyard of Pourrousseau. And maybe Jasper could add a word about those two vineyards and how he feels about.
Yes, I've actually been learning more about the Pourrousseau through your wine, because to begin with, it was considered to be a nice vineyard, but not quite the same level as Charme, Genevrière, Perrier, but now it's my next favorite, I must admit.
Yeah.
They're wines which always have a good structure, and they seem to keep extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
Then Charme, it's very interesting that when Dominique turned the domain biodynamic during the second half of the 1990s, Charme was the vineyard that reacted most. And previously, it had been a little bit, I don't know, fat, maybe mm-hmm. you'd say. And it just gained in precision. It kept all the intensity it had before, but it gained in precision. Whereas Genevrière was being got absolutely spot on beforehand and hardly needed to change. Maybe we could ask you, if you've had a chance to taste the first three wines, if you'd like to tell us how they're tasting today.
Say a word about the Perrier.
Oh, wait, yes. We should also, Dominique will also talk to you first about the Perrier 14. Yeah.
So Perrier, it's higher on the hill. More shallow soil, and it always produces wine of which have more tension than in the Charme, with an amazing complexity. It could turn with a floral characters on the nose. I think you'll get reduction first, and then if you turn the glass, you'll have much more coming out. You're combining a vineyard of tension and a vintage of tension together. So it's super tension for the 2014, I think.
But there's also always the most body in the Perrier, the most weight, the most body. So it fulfills those two functions. It's why it's the one vineyard which could conceivably have been made as premier, as Grand Cru in Meursault, because you have this amazing intensity of flavor and yet also the minerality side of it. So over to you. Let's hear how they're tasting today.
I think you nailed it. Did you try the 14 Perrier on your side? Because the way you described it is exactly what it is. I think it's
We don't have the Perrier 14 because
our glasses are empty for the moment.
Our glasses are empty, and you know we like to drink mature wine, so we are starting with the 2009 Genevrier. Sorry, I've had that wine less than a month ago, actually, and not Jasper. Jasper is not as spoiled as I am.
Not in that instance. And how are the 2017s showing?
Excellent. I think more open than the 14. I think a bit more open than the 14.
Yes, I would expect that. Mm-hmm. Yes. For me, in my own cellar, I'm totally comfortable to drink 17s, but I'm still keeping all the 14s that I have mm-hmm. for later on.
I opened a Genevrier 14 over the weekend, and I think it's really good, but still too young, and we didn't finish the bottle, and it was perfect after a day being opened and with that left in the bottle.
Okay, right. So the Perrier would be even more on the younger side. Great. So you've had the first three wines served, and that's it so far. Is that correct?
Yep. We are serving three we're serving next week.
Are serving them now. Okay, well, in that case, we can talk about them. So it's two vintages of Genevrier, 09 and 02, and then the 02 is alongside the Perrier. And now we get to drink as well, because 09 is possibly my favorite vintage that Dominique has ever made. He claims there are lots of others which are at least as good, but I just love the way the 09s have come out with him. And then 02, which is a vintage which is very nice for both red and white Burgundy, without being normally quoted as one of the legendary years. But it was a vintage which early on suffered a little bit from the premature oxidation. On the whole, I think it should have grown out of that, following my theory that the premature oxidation is a passage that the wines go through. And I have I've had your total about yes. Honor? Me too.
Oui, je l'ai.
Okay. So after the Genevrier 09, we also will have the Perrier 02 to taste alongside you. So now, in the days of René Laffont, the Genevrier used to get served after the Charme and before the Perrier on the grounds that it's the next best vineyard after Perrier. But Dominique changed that because he thinks that the power and the weight of Charme can sometimes drown the much more elegant and stylish qualities of Genevrier. And Genevrier is the sort of vineyard that if you have a blind lineup, it doesn't necessarily show, it doesn't stun you, because it is all about the subtlety more than the power. But when you sit and spend time with the bottle, then it's just gorgeous. So, I think your 09s, Dominique, are really coming into almost their perfect spot. So they're now, 14 years old? So that is where you want them to be. I'm getting a huge amount of aromatics out of this.
I love that bottle we just opened. It's in perfect shape. It's beautiful. It's super elegant as what you expect from Genevrier. With also, it's a very giving vineyard in terms of flavors. It's it opens more rapidly than a Charme or a Perrier. It doesn't mean it doesn't age as well, but it's always it's a very charming wine when it's young also.
Yes, I mean, I'm finding the bouquet, when you smell it, I'm still finding it almost too young. And then when you get to the palate, then it's opened out, it's flesh and...
It's because you are English.
It is because I'm English, absolutely.
It's always too young for English people.
No, but it's not just the English. The way that Burgundies are appreciated in Hong Kong, it really is wines with some age that people love.
Okay.
Do you want to serve the 02 something like that?
Yes. Un peu plus de couleur sur le
demi. Yes. So I'm looking at the wines against the dark surface, but even so, you can see that the 02 is our 02 Perrier has taken on a little more color, but the nose smells really good as well. 21 years old and in a really good place. So now we're beginning to get where the classic English palate likes the wines to be.
Exactly.
Mm. For a French person, maybe getting mature. So beginning to get, mine is sort of a fresh gold color. Now I've got a bit of light behind. Don't know how well you can see against my pink face.
Mm. Yes, sir. That's an amazing balance in the Genevrière Onarid, I think. I like the finish with there's a fresh acidity in the finish. It must be wonderful with what you eat. Those wines are begging for food.
Mm. Mm. Yes. So we don't have the Genevrière 02 to taste alongside you, but with the Perrier, I'm getting both the extra richness of the vineyard and also the fact that it's 7 years older and the vintage, which will probably have less body or at least is a little bit more forward than 09. The key to 09 is that you had to pick early. And people who pick late, the wines are a little clumsy, a little heavy. And any of the people who picked early enough have made utterly beautiful wines in 09. So it doesn't go down as a top vintage overall because not enough people got it right. But whereas in 14, pretty much everybody got it right. But the people who made the right decision on picking date in 09 have made some truly exceptional wines, I think. There we go.
Yeah. It was a large crop.
Yeah.
But it's not a big issue for Chardonnay anyway. Right. When 2002 was a smaller crop.
Mm. 2002 was
slightly,
the year.
Yeah, I would say slightly riper than 09, or maybe we used to pick later at that time.
You also did, yes, because it was a year which was still in the balance at the beginning of September, having had a not such great weather immediately before. And then the wind switched around to the north wind, which is dry, which is crucial. But it also means you get a slower ripening because you get less heat at that period. So I think at that period, you could say that it was easier to choose the right time to pick.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
So over to you, please, for your impressions. Who's going to speak?
Great. Very nice. Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Very, really, really. Can you hear that? Compared to the 14, it's just in a really good place. It's very open, round, I think it's generous. Beautiful texture.
Yes, it sounds exactly the same as our bottle, really. I mean, you couldn't imagine this being in a better place to drink.
So you guys tell us the differences between the vineyards, but do you have a preference, a personal preference for either one of these?
You're speaking of the vineyards rather than of the glasses in front of us, yes?
Yes.
I'll let Dominique answer that first.
It's complicated to answer because we like all our vineyards. I think if you look at the picture, the Perrier is the best wine in Meursault, and where we are located is just amazing. It has that almost Grand Cru statue. So a lot of respect for Perrier, quite intimidating sometimes. And I kind of like the joy you get out of Genevrière myself and that delicacy you have in Genevrière. It's a more tricky wine to make because when you hit the elegant side, anything you do wrong, you'll feel it in the wine. When a wine has more power, you know, if you do something wrong, it absorbs it really well. In Genevrière, it's like you make it great or it's not interesting to me. And I like that challenge every year. I like to look for the refinement you can get in Genevrière.
It's really opening up in the glass. It's mm-hmm. really blossoming. My reply is very similar to Dominique's. If you ask me which is the best vineyard in Meursault, it's going to be Perrier. But my heart is with Genevrière. I just love the subtlety and the detail. And also, it's you know, when I proposed to my wife, Abigail, my wife to be Abigail, we celebrated with a bottle of Meursault Genévrier. 1981, exactly. So, so it's always got a special place for me.
And amongst that, because we tasted Charme also, never forget Meursault Charme, because that vineyard was a slightly deeper soil that just tends takes any kind of weather, climate, an easier way. It's a very stable place to make high quality wines. It's always impressive, very well balanced, and I think with the vineyard we own, where it's located, I think the offer we do in Charme is quite exceptional.
Yes, because you're right up close to the Clos de Perrier.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, a really strong point to the Domaine de Complafond is that when the domain was started in the 1860s and then the years afterwards, there's actually another domain almost next door, Domaine Jacques Prieur. And Jacques Prieur took a decision that he was going to get some vineyard holdings in the top Grand Crus, Chambertin, Musigny, Morachet, etc. And Jules Lafont said, I'm going to stay more local, but I'm going to get the best plots in these vineyards. So you cannot be better located than the Lafonts in Charme. Genévrier is perfect as well. Perrier, there are three plots, but they're also very, very well placed. So that makes a difference, I think. It's not just the name of the vineyard, but it's where you are within that vineyard, where you have a larger size vineyard. Well, we're pretty excited by the two out of the three that we've got, and it sounds as though that you're doing well with those. But between the Perrier 02 and the Genévrier 02, is it fair to say that you're finding a big difference in favor of the Perrier?
Probably not a big difference, but the Perrier seems to come out on top today.
Right.
The intensity is there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Two more.
If they're both showing to full potential, that's what you'd expect. You'd expect to have more wine in the glass in the Perrier. But there's still a style to the Genévrier, which I'm very fond of. You may remember shortly before the first of the COVID lockdowns, I did a mainly Genévrier Lafont tasting in that very room, being physically present. And we just had a great evening with that vineyard. Okay, so check back and see what you've got coming up now. Okay, we now have a quartet, 296s, so the first real year of the Premox problem, a 93 Clos de la Barre and a 78 Désiré. So those last two are village wines, and the first two, of course, Charme and Genévrier, we've already tried. So are they being served to you now? Yes.
So, we have both 96s served.
Okay. Well, I'll talk a little bit about that vintage in theory, and then Dominique can talk about how it worked out at his winery. So,
generic. Sorry,
I think
let me do that. Hi, Jasper. Sorry, can I just ask a generic question? And yeah. I may not be using the terminology here. But just to talk a little bit about the Le Dit, the Désir and
Désiré, yes.
Pronunciation is probably not quite there. But just to understand the difference between the two and what the plots that you have and any other sort of further commentary on those across the different vintages.
Right. We have a little map on the wall, but I don't think that's going to come across. What I'll do is I'll take a picture of it. I'll send it to Scott, and Scott can send it round all of you or show it to you. While Dominique talks about the two vineyards.
Okay. So you want me to talk about Clos de la Barre and Désiré? Meursault Clos de la Barre and Meursault Désiré, I guess. That's what you're... Okay. So the Clos de la Barre is a monopole. We are the only owner, and it's next to the house. So we're actually with Jasper, we're now facing the Clos de la Barre. It's in the village of Meursault. It's a fairly shallow soil with a deep clay and very hard limestone rock, bedrock underneath. Clos d'Abar tends to ripen late and always keeps very lemony character in the finish when it's young. I don't know how is the 93 we're going to taste. I haven't had time to open it yet. When Désiré, which is slightly a little bit north of the Clos d'Abar, so we're going toward the Volnay, and actually that entire piece, if you look on the map, is called Pelure, and it's a premier cru. And in the area of Désiré, this is where, for example, D'Angerville makes a Meursault Centenot. There's also, if you plant it with Pinot Noir, it becomes Volnay Centenot, not Centenot du Milieu, but Volnay Centenot. And Désiré is an old name which was used before the AOC system in 1935. So I have super old labels of Désiré, from the 19th century. And actually, we kept that name on the label because we like it. It's half an hectare. It's a very special place, which tends to make wine which are much more charming, open to business quicker than Clos d'Abar. Clos d'Abar is always kind of lean, and Désiré is a rounder, softer version of Meursault. Clive Coates used to say it doesn't age well, and I've always had fun to open very old bottles of Désiré because it does age very well. And actually, it's the land is classified premier cru on the Désiré.
So one day the inspectors came to Monsieur Lafont, René Lafont, and said, "Okay, you're calling it Désiré premier cru, but if you want to stay calling it premier cru, you have to call it by the name Meursault Centenot. If you want to go on calling it Désiré, then it has to be sold as a village wine." And so René Lafont said, "We like to call it Désiré, we'll stay at the village level." And that, in fact, is probably accurate in terms of quality.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning when I was telling you, the premier cru northern part of Meursault, they don't get to the level of what you get in the southern part of Meursault. So it's good that it's a village.
And we know it ages a bit because at your wedding in 1988, you served the Désiré 76.
Yeah.
And I drank much too much of it, but still, I was young then.
We all drank too much.
Yeah. So, but before that, you had the 296s. And there used to be a saying in Burgundy that the wind on Palm Sunday, the Sunday before Easter, will be the wind for the rest of the year. Not every day, of course, but it will be the prevailing wind. And on Palm Sunday 96, it was a northeast wind, which gives you sunny days, but very cold, absolutely bright blue sky, but a cold wind. And that blew throughout the month of September and completely influenced the style of the harvest of 96. So the sunshine gave you sugar ripeness, you got reasonable degrees, but the acidity stayed high. And that then, in fact, became the first vintage which suffered a bit from Premox. So we're very much hoping that your two bottles are in fine condition. I've still got some 96s at my house, and when I opened them, they've all been fine recently.
And the one we tasted, great. Huh?
They were, yeah. So. Oh, yeah. O2 is beginning to advance.
I think those wines also, if you let them breathe in the glass, grow and show you more complexity. Mm.
So this is the. Okay, so that's still to come. So something else to say about the Clos de la Barre is that it is the first vineyard to flower normally, because the walls around it, that gives it a bit of warmth in the spring. But it's not that naturally that warm a site compared to the vineyards, the Premier Crus on the hillside. So it has a longer, slower ripening period. So in fact, it's often your last white to be picked, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it means it has a good long hang time. And though there's no suggestion in this wine that it ought to be a Premier Cru, nonetheless, it's a little bit special for a village wine. En goûte.
Ouais.
Oui,
il coule bien aussi. Non, mais je trouve qu'on, à la culture, quand tu l'éveilles, tu peux le voir tout de suite.
Tout de suite.
Et c'est bien ou pas.
Ah, yes. Ouais, so it's taking on just a little bit of color, but it's really bright, the color. And there's a waxy note to it. So 93 was a vintage which nobody really thought at the time was going to be special for whites. Whereas the reds may be, particularly in the Côte d'Ivoire. But then later on,
it was
the whites have just got better and better and better in our appreciation of them.
I think we'll have a kind of a similarity in terms of balance with the 93 and the 88 vintage.
Okay.
With this, the high acidity, the tension. But when all goes well, those high acid vintage, which looks very poor when they're young, just bottled, are amazing with time.
Yes. Never afraid of acidity.
What would you say is a modern equivalent then of a 93?
A little bit 16, but the frost vintages are going to be different anyway. Mm-hmm. There's an element of 14 in that, but we knew 14 was great almost from the start. It's harder to have a direct equivalent simply because everything is warmer and so the grapes are getting riper earlier.
13?
13 was more fragile, whereas 93 and 96 weren't. Yeah.
Yes.
No, so...
The limit?
2008?
A little
bit. But that's still not recent. Maybe 2024, who knows?
Yeah.
I don't think it's so hard. I mean, it's something I've always done all my life, tasting a new vintage, is look back for the parallels in older vintages. But since the global warming period really started to show in the wines, not necessarily badly, but it made a difference, then, so let's say from 2017, 2018, it is much harder to compare back to older vintages.
C'est super bon.
Ours, a bottle of the 93, is showing absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, there's to me, there's an amazing length for a village wine.
Mm. Except there's a slightly different aromatics in the Genévrier. I make a sort of link between Clos de la Barre style and Genévrier style.
You do.
I do.
I
you
don't.
But it couldn't be Charme, and it's not Perrier, and so on. But still. So how are your two 96s?
We're debating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know why they're talking.
To me, they're quite similar, actually. On the nose. Like, I'm trusting my nose more than my palate was for other reasons. But a little tiny bit of bruised fruit. Hard for me, it's... I think the Genevieve is a notch more complex. But... Yeah, quite similar. What do you guys think?
Well, I kind of prefer the
sharp. The
sharp, yeah. Yeah, more pleasant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But they're both showing a little bit of age from the sound of it.
Yes.
You know, typical 96, I think, right? It's I get this 96s.
Yeah. I mean, back in the days of, let's say, 2002 to 2005, the 96s were completely shot. I mean, you couldn't have drunk them. And since then, they seem to have, unless the cork has let them down totally, they seem to be coming back. But you still get, in certain bottles at any rate, you still get the remembrance of the Primox in that little bit bruised apple aromatic. It sounds as though you've got an element of that in those. But when we tasted the 96s here for the 40-year retrospective, which I'm halfway through writing up. But we've done an amazing thing over five sessions of tasting wines over the 40 years of Dominique's career. But the 96s then came out well, but there were bottles that hadn't moved from the winery. Okay, so how about the 93 and the 78 Désiré? How are they?
We don't have 78 yet.
We don't have 78 yet.
Oh, you don't have 78. What was the...
Yeah, some...
78 is being poured now.
Ah, okay, right. So you do have the 93 Clos de la Barre.
Yes.
And now you're getting the 78 Désiré being poured.
Okay,
yes.
Oui.
That's going to become huge. C'est bien.
You're having the Désiré 78 now?
Being poured now.
Good. Wow. Yeah, can you pass us some? We looked for it. We wanted to taste it, but there are no bottles left here.
There's so nothing left, so I don't know how it is.
You could be drinking the last bottle in captivity.
If you compare 78, is an amazing vintage for reds. To me, one of my favorite vintage for red Burgundy. It was a super late harvest, late October, and it was a very high acid, lean vintage for whites when it was young. I haven't made those wines. It's my father made it, but I remember how they were when they were young. To me, it's not my favorite vintage for whites anyway. And I'm curious to see how it goes. It was also I kept on doing that afterwards. It's bottled with a light finding and no filtration, so you might have some sediment, so it might be a little slightly cloudy at that time. It's something I've tried to improve and work on it.
The first thing you did was change the dark bottle.
Yeah, because I'm sure if you look at the color of the Désiré, it's a traditional Burgundy bottle, which you can really see the sediment through. And the first thing I decided was to get darker bottles so you couldn't see the sediments. But you're 78. It's a difficult vintage. I don't know how it's showing. You're drinking history at that level, I think.
Got a very unusual nose,
yeah.
But it's incredibly fresh, like compared to the 93 and the 96s. Sure. It's amazingly fresh.
Bottle condition is very good.
I'm guessing it's only just been opened immediately before serving. Is that right, Sebastian?
Open at 7.
So 45 minutes ago.
How was the cork?
Challenging.
And has the 93 Clos de la Barre?
I think I prefer that. You like the 93?
Yeah. I think the 70 is still up for me. It's really different.
It's definitely different.
Actually, it's very nice. When it was in the glass immediately, and then it started to play.
Yeah.
But the 78 is quite interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So our 93 bottle really was in perfect condition, so that was great. And the 78, is a curiosity. I mean, the other thing about Désiré is that really it is a red wine soil. So that's sort of the reason why the character is always a bit different in that wine. So it's a wine I enjoy to drink. Well, I don't think I get an allocation from you anyway. So,
you know, that's fine.
So right. Okay, so now we have three more whites to come, all of the 92 vintage, which are, I think, Charme Perrier and Morache. So there you go. Dominique is not trying for the Morache, but we're going to have the Charme.
Ah, there might be 12-ish bottles left of Morache 92. So it's we keep it for the family. Well, maybe we'll have one for Christmas.
Yeah.
It's 92 is a lovely vintage, has been super successful. It was showing really well when it was young. It's on the ripe side, but the ripe side before global warming. I remember a very sunny, bright sky vintage, not much rain, and an incredible balance. Lovely wine, luscious, good balance.
I remember my en primeur offer of the 92 white Burgundies, and I said, but look, I can't promise you that this will be a truly great vintage, but I can promise you that the wines will be absolutely delicious. And in fact, they've gone on and stayed delicious. It was quite a large crop, but as we alluded to before, Chardonnay doesn't mind that. It's not a problem. We have the Charme. You will have Perrier and Montrachet alongside.
It's a great bottling of Montrachet, the 92.
Yes. I've been lucky enough to share it on two or three occasions. So on the bouquet of the Charme, there's just a tiny bit of...
Hey, Jess, one second. Can I just ask a question about the alcohol levels in the 90s versus today, or, you know, how has that changed over the decades from the 90s up to present?
The level of alcohol.
It's not dramatic in change. I mean, we used to pick, I would say, pre-global warming between 12-ish% alcohol and 13-ish% alcohol. And now we're more like 12.7 to 13.5. But if you look overall, you know, most of the wine, when it was 12, we chaptonized a little bit, it was 12 and a half. And I wouldn't say for whites, there's a huge change in level of alcohol because we tend to pick earlier than we used to. We don't wait as much.
Yes, there'll be occasional vintages which will have crept over 14 recently. But again, it's a question of choice. And there are some people who say, I need to wait till it's fully ripe. And they end up at 14 and a half or 15 and a half. And for me, that spoils the wine. And others who prepared to accept a fractional compromise and go in a little bit earlier when a few aspects of the grape are not completely ripe, but you have a good balance. Mm-hmm. But it's true that back in the 90s, it was reasonably standard to add some sugar. I mean, the good people, it would have been a small amount of sugar. The people who overcropped their vines would have picked at much lower degrees and added up to 2 degrees worth of alcohol through the sugar. But in those days also, it was people quite liked the idea of spreading out the fermentation so it lasted longer. And nowadays, people prefer not to do that because they think there's a bigger risk of deviations getting into the wine if you let it go on too long. So, do you have all three in front of you? If so?
The Montrachet should be the same. So we have
the Charme and the Perrier already.
Yes.
But you know, so we talked about the different generation. We talked about, like, you know, the dad making a 78, and then Dominic, you're making, like, you know, a lot, and you're passing on to your kids. Have the winemaking style changed, you know? When your kids are doing it, are they saying, you know what, I'm going to do it a little differently? Like, you know, has that changed at all?
It's a great question. I'm going to try to be short on the answer because we could spend a day on that. But for you to know, when I took over my father, the first thing I have done was do exactly what he was doing because it was successful, and my father was not far away, so he checked on me, and I had a lot of pressure from him, from the clients, from all around me, like, don't touch anything, the wines are great, and so on. And after let's say, 5-6 years of doing that, I didn't feel that good because I was just doing a copy of what my father was doing. And as you know, the copy is never as good as the original. So I started to think about what I liked in what my father was doing, what I disliked, what I was looking for in a wine. And I think it's very important to be personal in what you like in a wine. And I've tried to adjust on that over time because you don't twist, you don't change an historical domain like this in a year. You know, you do it bit by bit and you have to experiment and check it out. I think I like wine which have a bit more tension, a bit more purity. My father was very keen on weight, more weight in the wines, more new barrels also. I've just used less new oak and I've been really working on purity, tension on the wines over my career, which is 40 years now. And I've been now working with Léa, my daughter, and my nephew Pierre for four or five years together in the cellar. And the first thing I told them is, first of all, do it exactly the way I do it. Because you need to learn first. You need to understand what's going on. And I told them, then, when you feel really good about how you use those tools, how I do it, you have to think about, taking your personal soul in the wine and slowly adapt. So there will be a change. But I think it's always a change for good, because if you have a winemaker who makes wine as a recipe without feeling very good about it, the wines will be boring. I think you need to bring a very strong personality in your wines. And, they have education. I'm next to them. They have the collection of wines behind. So it's not going to be dramatic change. But, if you're not doing that job, if you're not looking for doing better year after year, it's terrible. I mean, how can you spend 40 years doing exactly the same thing without thinking, should I improve something? Should I look for something else? So I think it's very important, and for the new generation now, to keep in mind, that I'm not the best, that it can be improved. It can always be improved. And I think we'll be always looking for a better wine. And after all this time, if my father has taught me something, it's look for the best, And it's not do it like this, but look for the best. Don't compromise. But it's, the wine I've made, it's my wine, it's my personality, the same as what my father has done with all his heart. And he was really looking for his best with his vision. And I think you will see it's going to slowly change. But maybe if we see each other in 10 years' time, you'll feel like, the kids, they're really doing it well. It's not exactly what Dominique was doing, but it's going to be perfect because they have that attitude of looking for high quality wines.
So you started doing it like your father, then you started to work out what your own style was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took you a little while, inevitably, in order to perfect that style.
Exactly.
So it's really in the years, probably the last 15 years, mm-hmm. I think, that we have the pure and classic final Dominique style.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's come back to the 392s and tell us about how they are in your glasses.
Not a bad bottle. Excellent. Yeah. Good. I think a real step up from the 96s for us here.
It's a bit of vintage.
We would hope that was the case, indeed. And our charm is just lovely, and it's got that little bit of flesh of charm. It's open, it's welcoming. That's a good drink.
And yes, it's a bit more floral and maybe prettier than the charm. But the charm is
actually really, it's
the charm I like the best. Yeah, I mean, it's something
not the one.
Those 92s are made, I would say, very close to what my father was doing. Because I took over with the 84 vintage. And so by the time you start to understand how it's going, there's a little bit of an evolution, but very light evolution in 92. Maybe slightly less new barrel, a bottling of Genevrière slightly earlier. That's what my father was doing, but not much was changed.
Yeah. So anyway, when I do my report on Dominic's 40 years, that's one of the things that's going to come out. He talked about with each vintage, and here I made this change. Here I felt this. Here we did something different in the vineyards. So it's going to be a small book in its own right, I think, when that report comes out.
Well, what do you think is the most major change that was made? Or has it just been like, little pieces of change every single year? And that's
involved. It's a small fine tuning during all the time. I think the most dramatic change I've done is using jams, jam cork, which is from the vintage 2014.
13,
yes, sorry. And which makes, I was thinking of it, if I had used cork in 1992 or 96 or the 93, we would have exactly the same bottle here in the cellar than you in Hong Kong, because you avoid the variation by the cork with a jam. So when now it's a 30 years old white wine, the 92. And of course, the cork has an impact. If you open three bottles of Meursault Charme 92 or Perrier or whatever, you will not have the same bottle, which will not happen with the jam.
And how much changes was done in the vineyard and the style of farming versus what's done in the winemaking?
Yeah, in the vineyards, the huge change was turning biodynamic in 1995.
Yeah.
Dramatic change at that time.
So you had one difficult vintage in 98 when the weather conditions were really against. Apart from that, it's made a huge difference. And it's been really thrilling from my perspective to have been able to see a domain changing from conventional through to organic and then into biodynamics, and just seeing what a change it makes in a sense of precision, a sense of delivering the flavor of the vineyard, if you like, I think are much enhanced.
And was there much in the cellar and the tanks or the barrels you guys that was used, or has it been pretty consistent?
I think at the period of the wines that we've been tasting, it would be reasonably consistent. It's true that more recently, there's been slightly less long barrel aging. Maybe that would be true for the 17 and possibly the 14. But in the old days, all the wines would have a second winter in barrel. It wouldn't be taken out of barrel till around about Easter time. But now you take them out a little bit earlier, a bit more intact.
No, it was over 2 years.
For your father, yes.
For my father. Yeah. And now it's more like a year and a half in barrel.
I've just poured myself a little bit more of that Meursault Charme 92 because it's really gorgeous. Yeah.
Getting better and better. Every minute. The Montrachet keeps getting better and better every minute in the glass. It's just
good. Really,
it's stunning.
The Montrachet was the first vintage I took over the sharecropping agreement from Pierre Moret. So it's the first vintage I worked the vineyard myself. I remember I was very proud of doing that. And I pruned the entire piece myself. I was so happy to be able to get in that vineyard. And it's also the first vintage where we have the entire crop of the vineyard. We used to share with Pierre Moret, half for him, half for us.
So you ended up with five or six barrels because it was.
It was five, I think, in 92, five barrels, 1,500 bottles produced.
Terrific. So I am going to ask on your behalf the question which is normally asked at the end, but we can do it again with the red wines. So Dominique, if you could have one white wine vineyard that you don't have, what would it be?
What a question. In Merceau?
We have
them all.
You have them all. So no, it doesn't have to be Merceau.
I'd be kind of, if you want to spoil me, get me a piece of Chevalier Montrachet.
Okay. If a Premier Cru level, which Pinot Noir Chassin Premier Cru would you like to have? Or Saint Thomas?
Something in Puligny nice, Pucelle, for example.
Pucelle would be my choice.
Yeah, Cailleray, Puligny Cailleray. I was thinking of having a nice piece in Chablis in Les Clos.
Ah, Chablis Les Clos. Okay. Sold, Dominique Lafond. Now, we can stay with you another 10, maximum 15 minutes. We have the reds. Are you ready to go on to the reds, or do you just want to spend a little more time with those whites?
We can pour the first red.
We can pour all three reds.
Pour the first two, I think, which are the two that we've... or even the first... Pour the first three, 02, 99, and 90, because we have the 99 and the 90, I believe, to taste. And then we'll leave you afterwards to enjoy the 89 and the 85. So if you'd like to pour the first three. So the red wine,
Just before you get to the reds, can I just go back to the my rather vague question about the Lourdes before? And it's not so much a question, but more a request to describe the different Lourdes in the particular vineyards. And I know that most of them have them. Ginevra has it, Perrier has it, Charme has it, etc. And I, again, my pronunciation is not going to be the best, but I ask it not just to improve my own knowledge, but I know that a lot of people who are subscribers and who listen to these Zooms, they do it not because they want to live vicariously through us, but actually because they want to learn some of that detail, and I know some of it's in your book as well, of course, but this is a great way to deliver the information. So, again, the question is not specific. It's more just to understand, you know, what does it mean when you have that nomenclature, for example, you know, from Dominique's perspective, what does it mean from a plot perspective? What does he have? Does one give a particular feature, for example, as there's more minerality, for example, in a particular place. So I'll stop talking, but that was sort of the essence of what I was asking.
And by Lourdes, you mean all the vineyards, not just the Premier Cru ones?
Yeah, 100%, yes, that's exactly what I mean. So where they are specifically named and labelled, and we have a map in front of us, and thank you for sending the one that you did. But there are, some of those are actually labeled on the map that we have. I don't know if you have that.
Right. No, but I've seen it. Scott, in fact, just sent me, showing me the maps you've got.
Yes.
So, if we take it from the top, about the names, first of all, and then Dominique can add the character that he perceives. So Perrier, it sounds as though that means stone. Pierre is stone. But in fact, it's a medieval word meaning a quarry. So the stone's been taken out. And you can see, if you go and study it, you will see that the Perrier is in several terraces where large blocks of stone have been taken out to build the houses and the villages. So Perrier, you always expect to get, nonetheless, quite a mineral quality of wine. But also, in the case of Merceau, you get the most power as well. Do you ajoute quelque chose? C'est bon.
It's fine.
Genevrier, officially, Genièvre means juniper. I mean, the old word for gin used to be Geneva, which is, again, it's all the same word. And so now somebody has planted, they've just rebuilt a little bit of a dry stone wall a few years back on the edge of Genevrier, and they planted a juniper bush alongside. Now, I don't think you can particularly pull out a juniper taste in Genevrier, but you do get something which is a little bit herbal.
I think they said, to me, sometimes in Genevrier, you get something which I call oriental, because there's spices, things like this, Florence spices. in Genevrière with a beautiful complexity.
Okay. Then we'll go to Charmes. Now, almost every village has got a Charmes. In the case of Genevrière, it's Grand Cru, Charmes Chambertin. Elsewhere, it's usually Premier Cru. Sometimes, as in Pudigny, it's village. But everywhere has got a Charmes. They all have the same character. They're all on the lower slope. They've all got a fair amount of topsoil. They all make generous, easy to appreciate, charming wines. Whether it comes from, some people suggest that it could be, there's a type of tree, a charme or charmy, which is a hornbeam. I can't believe that it comes from that. Some people believe it's a corruption of chaume, which exists from Romane Le Chaume, for example, which means effectively a hay field. And that's probably true enough. It's not far from the village. It'd be easy to cultivate that way. And it's never a steep slope. So that could be true. And a few diehard academics who look at everything from a pure language point of view say, Charmes, the H has got in by accident, but really it's a corruption of a word meaning rock. But I don't believe that at all because it's not characteristic of the wine. Weirdly enough, Charmes actually nowadays denotes a wine which is going to be amongst the more charming of the village. But that has to be coincidence because back in the day when the vineyards were named, people weren't making single vineyard wines, mostly. Porrezo, I have no idea.
But the name, it's a weird name. We don't know where the name comes from. I don't know. We don't know. I discovered Porrezo not that long ago, only 11 years. So I get to learn more about the personality of this vineyard. It started when we just took over by just being kind of powerful, rich, in the style of what you will find in the Goutte-d'Or also, which is due to the strong clay you have in that area. And I think with the work we've done at, in the soil and the organic and biodynamic, we gain a lot of refinement in the finish of this wine. And if you look at the map, I think it's an interesting position, the Porrezo. It's in between the Goutte-d'Or, which makes super powerful wine, and Genevrière, which makes super elegant wines. And to me, maybe I'm wrong, but my feeling is that nowadays in the Porrezo we produce now, you get at the start of the wine, in your mouth, your first feeling is power, richness, intensity, tension. But in the finish, I feel a little bit of the elegance you find in Genevrière. But it's a rougher wine than Genevrière.
A Goutte-d'Or, which just means the drops of gold. I mean, just descriptive, I think, of a nice place on the hillside. Don't think it has more than that, no? In significance.
Ça a été, on a donné le nom pour le vendre aux yes. Américains, peut-être.
Dominique, just saying they gave it a nice name to sell to the Americans. And, of course, it was the preferred wine of President Thomas Jefferson in the late 18th century. He was always looking for some Goutte-d'Or from Mercer. And the last one which you have is the Boucher, which some people write as two words.
Yeah, bouche, yeah. For mouth, expensive.
Yeah.
Boucher is like to me. We talked a little bit about the Goutte-d'Or, which is to me the most powerful wine in Meursault, but you know it doesn't get the elegance. You get in Genevrière, for example, you cannot get both in Goutte-d'Or. You get intensity, power, tension, great minerality, and wines which you cannot approach too young. They need time. Boucher, which is up on the hill, lighter soil, to me is a kind of a cousin of Genevrière. It's full of elegance. It's a lighter style than Genevrière, so it's not as round as Genevrière. There's a nice minerality, but there's also something very elegant, very subtle. And, you know, back home, if I want to open Premier Cru Young it's either Genevrière or Boucher. And the first I open is Boucher.
Boucher. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Perfect.
Any more questions about those or it's fine? You get your answers about the vineyard description?
Okay. In which case, let's move on to the three reds that you have in front of you. I just have to find them on my list. So you have 02 Volnay Sentinel, 99 Champon, and 90 Volnay Sentinel du Milieu in both cases. Sentinel, because there are several different parts of the Volnay Sentinel vineyard, and that bit in the center, Sentinel du Milieu, is definitely the best of them. Tu nous sers le champon? So
non, c'est pas champon que j'ai. C'est 200 que j'ai.
Ah oui. Ah bon.
C'est 199
et 90. En fait, ils ont bon, ils ont changé.
Ils ont quoi?
Ils ont que le champon.
Encore 99. Okay.
99. Tu veux que j'essaie d'en parler? Non, c'est bon. So the Sentinel is, I mean, it's also sort of Lafond red flagship because they have 4 hectares of it.
Half the appellation.
So yeah, that is half of the Sentinel du Milieu, and therefore it is the wine, the red wine of theirs that you will most typically see. In fact, it's grown in Meursault. It's just a courtesy title because Meursault doesn't do much in the way of reds. So they decided to include it under the name of Volnay, even though the vines lie within Meursault. 2002, a very charming vintage for red Burgundy, which I've always liked. It's not the most powerful. It should, I would guess, be sort of fully ready to enjoy now. We have by chance, in fact, I know that you're tasting the 99 Champon, and the bottle we've got here is 99 Sentinel. So the Champon is a smaller holding chez Lafond, and its feature, though, is its very old vines. So somewhere we planted in 1989. But the majority is still the planting, which is probably dates back to 1917. Mm. So over 100 years old now, a bit less than that, obviously, at the time that you taste it.
'99 was a great sunny vintage for reds. And it was... it's a bon tabac. It's been produced at a period where all my generation we all worked on extraction. So I think we produce reds which are more subtle, more elegant nowadays than we used to do at that time. You have to remember that now. Pinot Noir and Pinot Noir, great Pinot Noir from Côte d'Or are so much in fashion and so much in demand. When I started making wine, it was hard to sell. And one of the things that people were mentioning at that time, either critics, clients, whoever, was like, there's not enough color and the wine is too light. So with, my friend, like my brother-in-law is Christophe Roumier and Etienne Grigaud and Patrick Bees and Jacques Cesse and all that. Jacques kept that lightness in the wine. But we worked on doing more pigeage, longer maceration to add more color to the wine. It's a period where Burgundy has produced wine in that style. And if you combine larger extraction with a sunny and nice vintage, it makes something which is really... powerful. I would not make those wines the same way nowadays, but they age super well. If you look at the color, it's a very light evolution. I think it can go for another maybe 20 years. It's not a problem now, Jasper.
No problem. That's true of the 99. 02 should be a little bit lighter and a little bit gentler than the 99. And then the third wine that you have now is the 1990, which is a potentially great vintage, which some people have accused of being a little bit, at the time, people said it's a Californian vintage, because by the standards of those days, 90 was a pretty warm summer. So that's what we're going to try now. But it's always been one of my favorite vintages that Dominique has made, albeit in the slightly more extractive style. But the grapes, and, oh, that's a fabulous bouquet. I've never tasted the 90 as good as this. Have you?
I don't taste many 90s. Yeah. But it's lovely, and it's not the bottles I've been opening recently. Also, because those two vintages, 99 and 90, they were young. And they needed time, so we haven't drunk much of those. Yeah. And I think now it's getting there.
Immediately, there was a rich, ripe cherry fruit came out, and the tannins much more resolved on the palate than the 99 was. So this would have been, 13.5 natural without any difficulty at the time.
I think the tannins in the 90, when the wine was young, was stronger than the tannins in the 99.
But it's no longer the case.
It's no longer the case.
So the tannins have resolved into the wine. Our dear late friend Jim Clendenin always used to talk about resolved tannins, and that's the case here.
But acidity, right. Ça c'est 90, tu vois. There's a great finish. There's great acidity in the 1990 also, which carries the fruit.
It's actually hard to believe that's a 33-year-old wine, really, in our bottle, at any rate.
Ça, à mon avis, ça bouge pas, ça, en plus. En voyageant, ça bouge pas, ça bouge pas.
So, you have now the three reds, the first three reds, with two to follow. Any commentary you'd like to make?
I think Jay and I were saying, like, the 90, the tannins is actually still there. It's more resolved, but this could last a couple more years at least.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
a couple
more decades.
Yes. Decades, perhaps, yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
No question. Vintages like 90 and 99 are pretty much ageless. If you can keep the bottles in good condition and the cork doesn't let you down, there's no reason to put an end date on that.
It seems like we both have bottles that's in pretty good condition tonight.
Yeah. They're all good. Really nice. Yeah. The O2, I think, for me is great too. I love the freshness of it. You know, it's the fruit is younger, whereas the 99 and the 90 are, you know, the fruit is definitely more evolved. But I love where the O2 is right now for me. It's a pretty, very pretty wine.
Our 99 was more backward, but it wasn't the same vineyard, because we had the Sontenot and you've got the Champon. So it could be the difference between the vineyards, as the Sontenot tends to be the most powerful and probably the longest aging, but the Champon does also age well. And it can just be one bottle is a tiny bit more evolved. But I would normally expect a 99 to be showing as younger than an O2, normally. If everything is in perfect condition. So, I mean, I think when the question comes up, who do you know who actually makes good red wines and white wines, because it's not that common for people to get both sides right, then I think Domaine des Comtes Lafond is always one of my replies, because I've always been a big fan of the Volnays. And I have a lot in my cellar. At the moment, the 07 Volnay Sontenot for a lighter vintage is beautiful. And I had a bottle of just a little baby Montelie Duresse 2011 last week that was gorgeous.
Good.
So there are some super less expensive wines. And then the Sontenot, normally considered to be the standout. Now, you have two more wines, which we don't have, 89 and 85. 89 Champon and 85. Sontenot, Emilia. Yeah. Dominique, what should we expect to find in those wines?
Well, 89 is another sunny, ripe vintage. quite early picking. It's my daughter's birth year also. It was not in that 89. There's only the super old wines, which turned 100 years old in 2017. So they were 70-ish, 75 years old at that time. I like the vintage. In on the ripe side of it, I like the vintage. Then I hope you have a great bottle of the 85 Centeno. We don't have much left here in the cellar, maybe four or five, and a couple magnums. I mentioned that to me, my favorite vintage, old vintage for Red Burgundy was 78. But side by side with the 85 vintage. And I've had amazing wines, not only from my domain, but I've had the chance because my first job was working with Becky Wasserman, and those wines were on the market when I was young. And the best reds I've tasted in that period were 78 and 85. Mm. So it's a lovely. It's 85 is. Softer than 89. It's very much in balance. It's a kind of a late picking, as in the old time, but with ripe grapes compared to 78, which was not as ripe grapes as 85. The tannins are beautiful and the fruit is amazing.
So, something for you to look forward to. Before we let you go to finish the meal, and we have to leave as well, shall I ask Dominique the same red wine question as the whites? I'm going to limit you to the Côte de Beaune, so you can't have
any
tea.
No, I want Musy.
He could have his pick, right? Côte de Beaune, Côte de Nuit.
So Musy or Amarez, if he's allowed Côte de Nuit, but in the Côte de Beaune, what other red wine vineyard?
Pomarougien
would be the selection, yes. I can
say au Volnay Carré.
Au Volnay Carré, okay.
Just over the last, have you done the, I guess like your retrospective of like the 40 years, was there any particular vintage or particular wine that stood out to you that you're like, wow, like, you know, in the last 40 years of Lafon's winemaking?
Oof. We did have a couple of surprises. Am I going to be able to remember them? What was really interesting was that, so Dominique, when we were tasting the younger ones, was saying, okay, this wasn't really the style maybe that I wanted to make, but they were still held up really well. And then we came into the sweet spot. So certainly the things which I expected to show well, like 2009 did. This is frustrating me because I don't have it in the front of my brain. But there were a couple of things which really did.
2010 whites are amazing.
You always like 10 more, and I like 9 more, and I haven't changed that particular opinion. But I think I remember the 93 whites showed extremely well. I've got a nagging feeling there was something that we didn't really expect, and we thought, oh wow, that's good. I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait for the article to come out because I can't remember it off the top of my head today. Do we have a last question? Or comment for Dominique before we leave you?
Silence. What is most favorite young vintage for white?
So what is the
most favorite young vintage for white?
Most favorite of the young ones for white. What's the answer?
I'm thinking of it. Recent. I would take 17. 17.
Yeah. The challenger, the possible ones are 14, 17, 20, 22.
20,
22. And then between those, some people think 15, some people think 19, but I think 17 and then 20 is going to be very similar to 17.
And 22.
And 22 as well. Yeah, not bottle yet.
Right.
So, but Chris, I mean, what you have to do, you just have to buy a lot of all of them, then we'll be fine.
No, but it's, you know, the global warming did not, I don't think it affected the whites, the Chardonnay, as much as the Pinot Noir. So we're in the line of a super vintage, recent vintages for whites. And I was...
I mean, we know how great California Chardonnay can be in a much hotter climate. So there's no reason why Burgundy whites can't be as well.
And I was with the Barry Bros team this morning, and I was telling them, you know, we talked about the vintage, the 22 vintage, which, of course, you haven't seen. It's in barrel at the moment. And everybody raves about the whites 2022 because it's a great vintage. But I said, yeah, it's a great vintage as usual, as good as the 19, as good as the 20, as good as the 17. Different in style, but it's at the same level. So it happens quite often that we get to that level of quality with the Chardonnay. When to me, the 2022 reds are exceptional. They are very special. It's more tricky to get to that super quality with Pinot Noir year after year. It doesn't mean the others are trash and not interesting, but the highest level, which I mentioned with very old wines, the 85, the 78, with reds, it's once every 5 or 8 years you get to that level. It's easier to reproduce that level of quality with Chardonnay.
I would say that in reds, the 22 is the best vintage, certainly in the Côte d'Aubon, since 2015.
It's better than 2015, so better than 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 10, maybe 10, 9. You know, it's been a long time.
It's one of the really good years.
At that level of quality, I think.
So thank you all for being with us today, and thanks Sebastian and his team for great service and the restaurant, as ever. It sounds as though pretty much all the bottles have stood up to where we would have hoped, and that where we've had the same, they've been quite similar. So we're going to sign off from here, but just to say what a terrific time together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And I will see you in Hong Kong in January.